RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
The chances are you'll be very familiar with the work of my guest today, although you might not realise it. It could be when you have that first cup of coffee in the morning, or when cradling a hot bowl of soup in your hands on a cold winter's day, or submerging yourself in a deep foaming bath. It could be even extremely up close and personal in those very private moments while reading in the smallest room of the house. Robin Levine and his company Studio Levine have been responsible for an astonishing 15% of all bathroom suites sold in the UK. His work in the field of ceramic and product design has earned him a prestigious array of awards. He is known for his desire to make things better through design, something he has been doing since the 70s, be it the humble garlic crusher to a bathroom shower. All get the same rigorous Levine treatment on their journey from drawing board to the consumer. I spoke to him at the close of an energetic and rather noisy RDI summer school at Dartington in Devon. Robin, when I think of ceramics and ceramicists, I always think of potters, and I think of people like Bernard Leach and Lucy Ray. Could you describe the distinction between what you do as a sort of ceramicist and a potter?
Yeah, and that was a very big decision for me in my days at university, because I suppose handmade pottery would be where I started at school, and it wasn't until I got to the central school that I discovered an alternative to handmade pottery, which was in fact the industrial method of making pottery in a plaster mould. And it's quite interesting, I actually was a bit rebellious and made a series of slip-cast pots to mimic hand-thrown pots. It was partly because they'd tried to make me throw pots on a wheel, and I'd resisted it and fought it and decided I wanted to work with moulds. And it was a sort of piss take on Bernard Leach, and most unbelievable thing happened. I put my work up, and it was the first day, and I was standing there proudly beside my slightly ironic, rather silly work in a way, and who should come in through the door but Bernard Leach and Soji Hamada, the two great figures of post-war pottery. And it was quite a shock and unexpected, and they didn't really understand what I was trying to say. But it was sort of helpful in me being sure that I was going in the right direction.
And of course, I think the other thing to note that, you know, some people might not know is, of course, the area that you're working in is very much about industry. It's about being able to reproduce something on a grand scale, whereas with the classic potters and ceramicists, they are dealing with one-offs. Literally, every single item is different from the last. I mean, there may be a similarity, but they are handmade and therefore unique. So I think that was a distinction I wanted to get across to anyone that might not understand. Because there are a lot of people, actually, funnily enough, that actually often imagine that everything is thrown by hand, which is ludicrous, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back a bit in a moment. I just want one of the things that I find kind of amusing, really, is that, you know, when you think of designers, the idea of someone designing a lavatory is not the most glamorous thing, but we all use them. You know, they're part of life, they're part of, you know, they are an important part of our life. And therefore, to have someone, you know, labour and think about the comfort and, you know, the ergonomics, the whole feel of them is very important. When you go to parties and people call you in the room, two things I want to ask you. One is, you know, what do you say what is the first thing you say when someone says to you, well, what do you do for a living? And the other thing I wanted to ask you is that because you're so distinguished in that area, the area of bathrooms and bathroom fittings and baths, do you get your inspiration in one of your baths?
Well, to answer the last one first, not necessarily, but occasionally. Funnily enough, I could turn that around a little bit. I do bathe in one of my own designs, and it's a double-ended tub, and my wife, Tricia, and I can often be found on the weekend, because we're together most at the weekend, actually in the tub together, having some very important conversations. And actually, she is a big part of my inspiration. So in a way, yes, a lot of inspiration comes from being in the bath.
I want to reel back now to the beginning, probably the late 50s when you were a young boy. What kind of boy were you?
I think a very typical suburban kid, short trousers, permanently grazed knees, box carts, bikes, milkman, you know, with a horse. We lived in a semi-detached suburban house in West London. My father worked for BOAC, that then became British Airways, and he had to be within striking distance of Heathrow. And it was terrific. We lived in a cul-de-sac, you know, so there wasn't a lot of fast cars whizzing by. And our garden at the back, there was a gate in the fence that opened out onto a sports field. It was one of the London University's sports fields. So as kids, we could just go through the gate at the bottom of the garden and run around on sports fields in an area of rough land, greenbelt land. So it was hardly bucolic, but at least we had some real freedom. And, you know, I can remember my mum sort of shouting from the back garden to get us in for tea and all that sort of thing. So looking back, a terrific, happy, contented, good family background. I had brothers and sisters.
And what about your siblings? I mean, was there a creative gene within the family? You say your father worked for BOAC. What did he do?
He ended up in quite a senior position. He went from the Air Force, where he flew Catalinas. He was a pilot in the war, flying boats, Catalinas. And he had the choice of either going into the civil airlines or staying in the Air Force. And he chose to get out of the Air Force and not drag his family around the world for you know, for however long. Mm-hmm. He isn't artistic. He's still alive, my dad, at 93. My mum died in 2000. She was the artistic bit of the family, was an amateur painter and interested in art. So I have a mixture, really, from my parents. My dad being a very controlled, steady person. He ended up actually in heading up the control center of BOAC and British Airways worldwide. Oh. So when he was at work, he was in charge of the operations of that airline worldwide.
Wow. And what about your brothers?
Yeah, I have... there's four of us, four kids, and my older brother is in his 60s, and my sister has just turned 60. I'm in my mid-50s, and I have a brother just a bit younger. So I'm the third of four kids. My sister was a little bit of a, a surrogate mum in a way. I mean, she was of an age where she could spend time with us two younger boys. And she is very artistic. She ended up in teaching and was very good and interested in art and definitely an influence on me. We didn't have TV for the first, most of my childhood through the 50s and early 60s. And I think it was a tactic of my mother's, because when someone in the street did get one, we were always around there and she got a bit of peace. But it was the typical thing of making things at home. We had Meccano. We had a sand pit, which I spent many happy hours in, you know, creating dreams of the future by making things. Looking back, it was probably fairly formative stuff.
And so tell me how your own creative journey started. I mean, when did you start sort of feeling that you wanted to pursue a creative career? Maybe not knowing what it was, but how did it actually manifest itself?
Yeah, it was really at school I was more interested in subjects where I could make drawings. So I liked biology and I liked geography, and it was the drawing of things that I liked particularly. And it was interesting because I did like art as well, and I remember a careers advisor. I sat down in front of him and he sort of asked me what I was interested in, and I said biology and art, and he thought about it for a bit and he said landscape gardening, which actually makes a lot of sense when you think about it. So I was taken by my parents to a landscape gardening college. I think it was called Merrist Wood. And I went and was shown around and tried to get a feel for what that might be like. And I was told that I would have to learn the name of every plant growing in Britain in Latin. And I hated Latin. Latin was the subject that I hated most. So that really scared me, the idea that I was somehow being pushed into something that wasn't going to suit me. And I think it was that moment when I started making my own mind up about what I wanted to do and realizing that it was somehow connected with drawing and art, and that's where my interest really lay. And I remember the headmaster of the school, we all wanted to look like the Beatles, you see, with the long hair, and he grabbed me by the sideburns and lifted me up by the sideboards and said, "You're not at art school yet, Levine." So I was a lost cause, basically, to the teachers and the headmaster. They felt I was one that had got away.
So you didn't have one of those inspirational teachers who was the seed to...
Well, of course, we all did, and I'm not excluded from that. And there is a little anecdote, if you'll indulge me, to tell you, where we did have an art master arrive, and I suppose I would have been 13 or 14 or something. And he absolutely fundamental person in my career, because he was interested in ceramics, and he brought a kiln and some clay, and he told us all to go away and draw something and bring it back to the class the next week, and that we would make it. So I went away, taking this all very seriously, went to the library and found a book on Chinese art with a fantastic image of a Buddha sitting in a very sedate manner. And I thought, right, that's what I'm going to make. You know, it's quite an ambitious first project. And I went back to class with my drawing, and I sat down, and there was a pile of clay, and I started building sort of a coil pot of this Buddha. And it took a couple of weeks to make, and I had it wrapped up in newspaper or whatever to try and not let it dry out too quickly. And eventually, all of our work, me and the other kids in the class, were put in the kiln. And the following week, the kiln was open to reveal our work, and sitting in amongst absolute broken up pots was my Buddha, still pretty much intact. Its foot had come off, actually, but otherwise it was sitting there resplendent amongst the ruins. And of course, everyone else hadn't quite got their pots dried out well enough, and they'd learnt something about pottery. But I'd been told it has to be dry before it can go in the kiln. And it was a big moment, and I got a pat on the back, and that was it. You know, that singular moment set me off on pottery.
It could have been something else.
Absolutely.
That one teacher. How interesting.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
So then you eventually decide to pursue that. You go to Central School of Art. What did you actually do there? Did you do ceramics?
Or you know, it was has been an incredibly singular furrow that I've ploughed, because from the moment at school, aged whatever, 14, 15, it's been pottery all the way. It's been ceramics all the way. So I went to do a foundation course and met another ceramics guy there and got a lot from him. And then I applied to the Central School. Actually, I applied to Bristol. For some reason, I thought I wanted to be out of a city. And so we were advised, you might get into your second college, so apply to the one you don't want to go to first, and then when you don't get in there, you'll go to the one you do want to go to. So I applied to the Central, not wanting to go there, and of course I got in. But then I went there, and the course was run by an amazing character called Gilbert Harding Green, a sort of Victorian queen with a walking stick. And he used to go into the kiln room where all our pieces were waiting to be fired. And if he took a real exception to something, he'd give it a sharp tap with his stick and actually break it, which is very brutal and surely shouldn't have got away with it. But that was the kind of character that we had to deal with. And, of course, looking back, it was probably as ugly as sin. But
so your foundation, unlike most foundation courses, where you actually dabble in many things, you just concentrated?
No, I was put through a foundation course with everybody else. Yeah. But I already arrived thinking I wanted to do ceramics, and I didn't change during that period. I did lots.
And so at the end of the foundation, you went straight on to Central to do the main course.
Yes, I did a 3-year degree at Central.
Yeah, and then you decided to do a postgraduate course.
Yeah, I did. I don't know how or why I was so aware of the Royal College, but it became a place I wanted to go and study more. Yeah,
I mean, the thing about the Royal College, of course, is that certainly so many of the royal designers that that are part of the faculty have all been through that place, which is probably not surprising. Really.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you were there, you one of your tutors was David Queensbury, who obviously was an influence on you because later you actually went to work, I think, for him, and then obviously after. Over a long period of time, 23 years, I think, you became a partner, mm-hmm. and the company became Queensbury Hunt Levine, and your reputation very much surfaced during that period. Tell me a little bit about that, how that all came about.
Well, he was my professor when I arrived at the Royal College in 73. I remember that they... Well, for the interview, they asked, written down on the piece of paper, we had to bring paintbrushes and watercolour. And I didn't know one end of a paintbrush from another. And it turned out that this piece of paper hadn't been changed and should have been, but that there was a fairly recently, before me turning up, they'd had to do decoration painting. And any applicant to the Royal College would have to sit down and paint some flowers. So thank God that wasn't still a requirement. But the interesting thing about the Royal College then, I think less so now, was that the professors were encouraged to run their businesses from the college. So within the ceramics department, David Queensbury's office and a small room to one side were actually his design partnership with Martin Hunt, another royal designer. Within our department, we had a ceramic design business, and that was obviously something that the students could make their mind up about. You know, did they think that was a good opportunity or something they might be interested in or not? But it was right there in front of us, and quite an important thing for me.
So your transition from in those early days when you went to work with David Queensbury. What were you doing? Were you just generally?
Well, I mean, if there's one or two, you know, we all have these key moments, don't we? Like the teacher and the pottery and all of those things. And David Queensbury was very good at bringing in tutors that somehow complemented what he knew about. Mm-hmm. And there was Eduardo Paolozzi, and there was Hans Cooper, the greatest, in my view, ceramicist of the last century. And I only had 3 tutorials with Hans, but I was heading off in a curious kind of arty direction. And he, within 20 minutes at the end of our chat, he actually enabled me to understand that art wasn't what I should be doing, but design. And it was just quite a profound moment. And it came rather late in my 3 years, and I had to catch up very quickly and start to learn about design. Mm. And I actually did it by teaming up with a couple of friends who were a year ahead of me and who'd left college. And when I graduated, the work I presented was the work of 3 people. It was Ben Kelly, Jeff Hollington, and I. The 3 of us worked together. It was a bit controversial. You know, I wanted to put their pictures up on my display because the 3 of us did it, and the college said, no, it has to be just yours. And we sort of said, shall we do a little presentation outside the college? But they said, no, Robin, you put your show together and put your name on it, and that's fine. You know, it's more important that you you graduate properly. And then I worked for Eduardo Paolozzi for about 3 or 4 months, maybe 4 months. He paid me an artwork, not a single penny, exchanged hands.
Well, that's a very wise thing to have done, actually.
Well, as it's turned out, yes. It was fine. Yes. I did dig it all out of the attic, and he paid me quite well.
Yeah.
So it was actually quite a shaky start, really. When I graduated from the Central, I'd made this amazing tea set that looked like a sort of Mad Hatter's tea party with jelly and all these kind of images. And it had been bought by somebody, and I'd sort of made about £500 or £600 and got a lot of appropriation, and people said it was great. And I kind of thought that that might be repeated when I left the Royal College, but it certainly wasn't. And the kind of design manifesto that Ben, Jeff and I put together was rather cerebral, and it was clearly part of my transformation into a designer, but it didn't hit the spot commercially, so I wasn't able to repeat what I'd managed to do on my degree course, so it was less certain, you know, that I was getting it right. I do remember doing some ashtrays for the art bar at the Royal College. The bar at the Royal College is still called the art bar. And Ben and Jeff designed the glass logo, you know, there, which is still there. Well, I did the ashtrays, would you believe? And
probably not there anymore.
It was fantastic. The ashtrays lasted about half an hour.
It actually was a big boost for me.
It was a big boost. Those were clearly popular, and I do remember making more of them up in the department and selling them to a chap called Christopher Strangeways, who had a shop down in Fulham. He was terrific because he bought them off me. He didn't say it's sale or return. He actually gave me the money. Mm-hmm. And that was just an early bit of trading, a bit of transaction, a bit of commercial endeavour that worked. I funded a trip with a mate hitchhiking around the States, you know, at the beginning of the summer by spending 2 or 3 weeks making these things, handed them over to him, he gave me the money, and off I went. Another sort of key moment, in a way, to make me realise that you could
actually
make some money out of that, maybe.
Mm. So how long after leaving the Royal College and having these little moments of business transactions, did things start sorting into place?
Well, actually, I was sort of trying to make my own way as a designer, as a freelance designer, for at least a year, living in a nice, relatively nice flat in Westbourne Terrace on the other side of Hyde Park to the Royal College. But I do remember it didn't go very well, and you know, I'm not a character that gets very depressed, but I did get quite low, and I remember some days not even getting dressed, and my confidence drained away quite a bit. But I stuck at it, and I did manage to get one or two things going. I went to Boots the chemist and managed to persuade them that I could design some table lamps, you know, for them. They do housewares as well. And they said okay, and I went to a factory in Stoke and I got them to make them. And it was never ever going to be very successful, but it was going through the motions, and people were doing things, and I was beginning to work as a designer.
Just tell me the process there. I mean, you go to Boots and you have an idea. This is just a self-triggered idea, and you are responsible for getting it to a prototype point without any sort of form of payment, and in the hope that they will fund you or
the idea, which is probably something I'd learnt from David Queensbury, that you could actually get a royalty on things. So if I managed to get Boots the chemist to place an order for these lamps, the manufacturer in Stoke would pay me a small commission on each one that Boots bought.
Yes.
So I understood that business model, and that was to be the basis of this endeavour.
So if it's based on a royalty, does that mean that there is little money up front, or just the development money? How does that work?
It is definitely usually the case, absolutely correct. So I think I was on the dole. I think I was paying the way by being on the dole and just scraping along, trying to get something started, not really understanding that to generate a substantial enough royalty income to live on would be taking 2 or 3 years. But at least I was on the road trying to do it and sticking at it. And funnily enough, I had decided that I wouldn't teach, because I had seen many people who had an ambition to do something. This idea, I'll teach a couple of days and I'll do my own work in the other three. And some people can do that, but I knew I wouldn't be able to. I knew if the money came in from somewhere else, I'd just gravitate more that way and I would not carry on. So I just wouldn't let myself do that.
So then what happened to...
Well, what happened was, I think, David Queensbury got in touch by phone or even a letter in those days, and just brought it to my attention that Terence Conran was advertising for designers down at Kintbury, which was his home in Berkshire, where he had a big design studio. And, you know, it might be the sort of thing I'd be interested in. And I did indeed apply, and I went down and had an interview, and didn't get offered a job by Terence. And pretty much at the same time, David Queensbury, I think, seeing that I was kind of getting it together and maybe I'd be somebody he could work with, and I'd sort of to some extent proved that I was motivated enough by sticking at it, sort of gave me a bit of work. And actually within about 6 weeks, one of the bits of work was for Habitat, and I found myself back down at Kintbury with some models for a meeting with Terence Conran, who then offered me a job. At which point I said, actually, things are shaping up quite well in London, and I think I'm going to see how that develops.
I think it's called the proof of the pudding.
Yeah.
Oh, so then, okay, then you stayed for this long haul with...
Yes, I did. I did.
It obviously developed. How quickly did it start to develop in terms of your position?
Well, I'd like to think fairly quickly, and David was very, very good at keeping everybody together, and he understood, really, that over an extended period of time that people might start to think about, you know, moving on and doing their own thing, and he basically, you know, it was a partnership of David and Martin equally owned and set up. And he understood that one way of keeping me around would be to make me a partner and to give me an ownership and to bring me into the business. And that was terrific, and it worked.
So that was that 23-year period. And,
yeah.
And then in 1995, you came to a big decision because you turned your back on that and started Studio Levine. How was that transition? Because these things can be... Having done a similar thing myself, it can be, you know, either a, you know, it gives you a feeling of great relief, or it can be very, or a combination of great relief and sort of sadness. How did it?
It was actually 1999 that Queensbury Hunt Levine, as it had become, was dissolved. And it was pretty tough on all of us, actually. It was... it was quite painful, and we between us, we managed it pretty badly in one way, and that was that we ended up deciding to basically what undermined us in the first place was a letter from the landlady where we were in Brookmuse North in a really nice studio to say that she was going to sell it all, it was going to be made into apartments. And that letter just unsettled us. It made us all think about the future and what were we going to be doing. But we decided to reconfigure the partnership a bit in an even more equal way and relocate to another studio. And we spent a year and we spent a lot of money doing that. And it was shortly after moving in that it finally fell apart. So we'd spent all this money, we'd moved in, we were in a new studio, and then we decided to split. And for the first 6 months or so, 9 months of Studio Levine and Queensbury Hunt, which was in a curious way a new business because Levine wasn't there, we operated out of the same space, and it was a nightmare, absolute nightmare, with a kind of Chinese wall in the middle, and we were all very unhappy. and it had to end, and fortunately it did. So it was difficult. It was emotionally difficult because, you know, he was my professor and we'd been in partnership for 20 odd years, and you know, he didn't want me to go, but I kind of knew that I had to, and it was the right decision. And people have said to me, you should have done it years ago and all of that, but you get settled into something that works and is enjoyable, and there's no real reason to go. But that was the moment, and it was the right thing, and it's certainly been the best thing I did.
And it kind of it coincided actually with a good year for you in terms of awards, because you received a DNA Do Silver Award in 1999, so kind of a nice little...
Yes, and it was terrific where, of course, you had it reinforced that the client relationships that you'd built up were still there, and yeah, that it was you that people wanted, and you know, so, and we all kept the main clients that we'd been working with. There were no issues over that. So I got off to a pretty good start, you know, and we bought a studio in Southwark. We had to sublet half of it because it was way bigger than we needed. But it was very exciting, and it was liberating. Mm. And David Queensberry had said to me once or twice, you know, that I needed to spread my wings, and that's what it felt like. It was, there was nothing negative to get away from, but it was just the independence, and you know, finally it was actually all down to me.
Yeah.
And it was great.
So it's now, as you said, not 95, it's 1999. So you're kind of, we'll be coming up to 10 years in a year or so's time. How have you fared in that time? How have you developed?
Well, it's a sort of touch wood situation, but we've really been busy the whole time. It's probably in some ways been a continuation of the old partnership, you know, the model and the way it's operated, and the roughly the number of people, and I've built it up to the same sort of turnover that the old partnership had. So it's quite similar. I haven't gone off in some big new direction. No. I've kind of carried on, but doing it, and I talk about it on my own, but it's with my wife, and she's my partner.
Yes.
And an important part of the business. So we've, yes, very much done it together. Yeah. And in a way, separating from the old partnership enabled her to become more involved again, because she hadn't always fitted in so well to that bigger structure.
Mm.
And of course, once I was on my own and she was on her own with me, it was rather more important for her to think about it as well. So it kind of brought her back into it, and our discussions in the bathtub on the weekends.
Well, I mean, talking about going back to bathtubs again, I mean, I was kind of taken aback to learn that 15% of all bathroom suites in the UK are probably designed by you.
Me and my direct connection. Yeah, I mean, me and I do like to try and include other people if I can, but me and my colleague Dave Tilbury.
Yeah.
And we're practically married. I mean, you know, he was with me through the partnership at Queensberry Hunt Levine, came with me to this, and he's my right-hand man.
Sure.
He's one of these backroom boys who is absolutely indispensable and puts a lot into all of these things. But yeah, between us,
15%. 15%. Pardon the pun, but that's a lot of bums on seats.
It is.
Because I think, you know, we're here at Dartington, the RDI Summer School, and maybe if I'm not mistaken, some of the fittings here are also...
It's almost inevitable.
Yes.
And I mean, there are 50 of us here, and I can stand up with total certainty in front of them all and say, you've all sat on one of my designs.
Yes,
absolutely, with certainty.
Yeah.
It's more, unless they arrived yesterday from, you know, Berlin or something and never been to the UK before.
But that is, I mean, that's really, I mean, design being in touch with daily life. I mean, being part of daily life without, you know, unconsciously. Maybe,
yeah.
But you're connecting with design, with it, you know.
Very much
so. Without even thinking about it, and that's what I find interesting.
Yeah, I like the idea that a lot of those products are quite anonymous and that they fit into people's lives.
Yes.
So they really don't need to know that I've designed it.
No, but I think the interesting about bathrooms and bathroom fittings and so forth, that I've noticed increasingly in recent years that, you know, more, if you like, signature architects are, you know, I'm of course, there's always been people like Philip Stark who would do all sorts of things. But there are major people like David Chipperfield, for example, maybe John Porson, I'm not sure, but it's certainly architects who are taking an interest in an area that perhaps before they would have just gone off and...
It's had its moment in the sun. I mean, it's still in the sun, as it were. The kitchen became the big focus, and the money was spent there. And then it moved to the bathroom, and the bathroom's been through a kind of renaissance. I mean, our studio range for Ideal Standard, which is now 25 years old, it was the early 80s and the boom of the whole Thatcher period. And when they asked us to design it, they said, it's not really a design story, this. It's for the mass market. It won't be a big, high-profile thing. But between starting and launching, when we launched it, it went straight on the front cover of Design magazine. Mm. And actually, it was a design story to bring good design to the mass market. Mm. And it's been a massive success. I mean, 10 million pieces and counting of one range, which is partly why there's so much of it out there.
Yeah.
But it was part of this resurgence of interest in the bathroom as an area for design, and you're right. Yeah.
One of the keeping on that track for the moment, moving away from the actual design process and thinking more about the business. One of the things that struck me about you and about your relationship with Ideal Standard in particular is that you're a non-executive director of that company, in which is, in my experience, quite rare. I mean, it's something that I know that certainly the Design Council and the Cox Report recommended very highly, and I totally agree with it, that the boardroom should not just have a finance director, it should have a design director as part of the mix, particularly if you're manufacturing. So what's your experience been as a non-executive director of Ideal Standard, and what role does that entail?
Okay, I mean, the non-exec bit's important because it actually gets you off having to go to all the board meetings. not that I would mind, but it does mean you're not absolutely day-to-day trying to make decisions and be part of the main board of the company. But you're fighting the corner of design, and it was a transition for me because it actually meant that I might be finding other designers to work for Ideal Standard, when over 20-odd years, pretty much everything in the UK, I'd been involved in designing. So it was an interesting position to be asked to take up. But I fairly quickly, and I think as designers we all reach a certain point where we feel fairly secure, and that we're not going to be threatened by other young whippersnappers coming up and pinching your business. And actually, I've got a huge amount of enjoyment out of recommending and bringing in other designers. Jasper Morrison I introduced, Pearson Lloyd, both in Royal Designers. And then working as a kind of go-between, the manufacturer and the designers, and helping oil the wheels and make things work and have both sides understand where people were coming from and be part of a team that is bringing really, really good design.
And how long has that role been in existence?
I guess it's about 4 or 5 years now.
And you found it works, and they're happy with the
Yeah,
results.
Very much so.
In their brochures, again, really, they always name the designers.
Yes, they do. They always
they
have.
They make a big point of that,
yes,
which is
yes,
which
they
very
do.
Few of
no,
the
No, that's right. And that hasn't been me pushing them to do that. They have actually always done that.
Mm.
And it's very motivational, I think, for designers. And
also,
you also have to take the responsibility. I had an email last week from somebody complaining about their toilet and a slight blemish on the side of it. And I was getting the emails. And one of the guys at Ideal Standard apologized.
There are plenty of things that can get out of
the office. Well, quite. It was a manufacturing fault. And I replied to the guy at Ideal Standard, if I'm being given the credit for designing it, I'm going to have to accept that. And I replied to the guy and tried to help him understand, you know.
Moving away from the bathroom for a moment, you're also very well known for a massive range of tableware, not just here but all around the world, but, major manufacturers. And you've also been doing a lot of work for, over the last 5 years, for John Lewis as well, I think. You've been doing quite a bit of work.
Yes.
A lot of them are very beautiful. I often wonder how you can come up with yet another variation on, a plate, a soup dish, and a side dish, and so forth. But you seem to have done that. You know, there's a beautiful range that I think the inspiration came from, Pebbles on the Beach, which is a lovely, delicate range. But it's not so much I want to talk about, but there's one item that you have designed, which I have, which I think is brilliant, and that is the garlic crusher.
Okay.
Because, you know, for years I've had the rather primitive French garlic crushers that you spend more time digging bits of garlic out of the grid than, and so you think, to hell with it, I'll just bash it with the back of a knife. But your garlic crusher is ingenious in that whole segment that gets so kind of gnarled up with bits actually flips out, and you can just scrape it off in an instant. And it's one of the best, I have to say, one of the best things I use more than anything else in the kitchen.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, as usual with these things, it's not quite as simple as it might appear, but the story there was I was going around a student graduate show in Islington at the New Designers Exhibition, and spotted a guy with one or two sort of kitchen gadgets, and he'd got an idea to make an easier-to-clean garlic press. And I picked it up and had a look and had a chat with him, and I just sort of thought, this could be something. And said, how would he feel that if I worked with him to make it into reality, to make it happen? It's a bit of a long story, but I then teamed up with yet another person called Anthony Griffin, who I'd got to know, who worked for Cole & Mason, who were a peppermill company. And eventually, actually, the three of us, and his original design, the guy's name was John Tree, who went on to work for Sony and is now Jasper Morrison's right-hand man. But John had got this idea, and we worked together, and we arrived at that solution as a small team. It took about 5 years to get that thing from that moment of meeting him out there into the market. It was a very long journey.
I don't know of any other garlic press like that. Has it been successful?
Well, you know what? It's the idea of hinging the grate. Mm. That's all it's about.
Yes.
That enables you to get that out and clean it.
Mm.
There's now about 25 versions of it, but all made by the company in China that we got to make ours. And every single one, there's a small commission.
Really?
So it's been a winner.
Well, that's staggering.
Yeah.
Well, it's
just an idea. It's the power of an idea.
The idea is so simple that it's staring you in the face,
yeah.
But nobody did it.
No, it has this great thing we like to try and get in a product, which is called the R factor. So you say to somebody, you know, what do you think about a garlic press? They're bloody things, you can't clean them. Well, have a look at this one.
Yeah.
Ah. And well, it's got
thing,
that.
The other thing that, you know, and I don't know whether it's unique or not, but you have, which seems to me to be a great idea, because I grate a lot of Parmesan, is the Parmesan grater and dish combined, where
yes.
you can grate on
direct,
the top of,
yeah.
and it goes directly
yeah.
into a little bowl instead of going all over the kitchen
yeah.
table,
okay.
which is what it does. That's
yeah.
another.
Well, you know what? There's a story attached to all these things. Commercially, a disaster, a failure. And I would say probably a couple of reasons, but the main one being that there's no other product out there quite like it. And actually, you can get it wrong by being unique. It's a lonely beach.
So it's kind of overlooked.
And nobody understands what it is, because they've never seen one before. I think Julian Brown, also a Royal designer, met the same issue with a can crusher. There was no other can crusher to compare it with. There was no choice. There was just his sitting there in the market. And it was unfamiliar. And people didn't say, oh, I've had one of those. That looks better. I'll get that one. And sometimes, you know, things can fail because they're the only one.
Mm.
And I think that's what happened there. We thought it was a great idea, but people didn't really understand it. And they looked at it and they thought you could grate cheddar cheese through it as well.
Mm.
But actually, it doesn't do anything to cheddar cheese.
No, I've visited your studio and noted that you seem to make everything to scale, all carved out of, I think, sort of that dense polystyrene sort of, whatever it is, green or blue.
Styrofoam. Blue styrofoam.
All made to actual size rather than I'm sure later it's added into the mix of the computer, but you seem to be I mean, how is that the norm, or is that rare? Or
I think it's becoming increasingly rare.
Yeah.
And of course, in my case, it's my roots in the pottery class at school making the Buddha. It's the idea of making
and feeling
and feeling and touching.
Yeah.
And I've just brought that with me the whole way through.
Yeah.
But you see, still, if you go to university art school today and do ceramics, most of your time is spent making. Mm. The British educational system in design is largely about workshops and making. Mm. And I think that's with me still. And so my method and what happens in our studio is that everything that goes out as a design has been physically made in some form. Pretty much everything. Mm. So a range of 30 or 40 things in a tableware range, the egg cup, the espresso cup, the saucer, every single bit's been made and fine-tuned. Mm. And sometimes we make 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 of the same thing until we get it right. Mm. So it's very much about trying to move things from 7 out of 10 to 9, mm. the hardest bit. And we find that the process of designing through making mm. enables us to shift things from 7 to 9.
And your method of working creatively with your fellow designers at Studio Levine, is it a very collaborative process? I mean, how do you work? I mean, most royal designers have become royal designers because of a personal signature, personal stamp to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But I wonder how much collaboration actually occurs within whether that's beneficial. For some people I know, they find it very difficult to work with others. They prefer to keep it themselves and hang on to things. But how do you work?
It's very much an art directing role, but it certainly isn't a dictatorial here's a drawing, just make this. We always try and sit down as a group when we have a new project, and everybody throws ideas into it. And then, but obviously, Tricia and I are caring perhaps just a bit more than anybody else that we get this right. Each one is an opportunity to have a successful product in the market and help to keep our whole thing on the road. So we might be drawing and sketching and bringing in ideas and thoughts and feeding this process that we have, this creative design process. Then usually one designer will kind of gravitate towards a project and pick it up, and they'll be the lead designer on it. But I'm very close. I'm at the studio as much as I can be, which is why I hesitated when I got the call offering me to be the master, because my colleagues sometimes get fed up when I'm not around, because they can't just work away for a few weeks and hope for the best. You know, they know that I'm going to come along, and if I'm not happy, it's just not going to go anywhere. Mm. So it is a bit dictatorial in that way. Mm. But it's not to say that they're not having a big creative input, and actually the output of the studio expresses them as well as me. I mean, as much them. It's a group activity. Mm. But I'm steering it, and that's not in a general way. I'm steering it to the millimeter. A little bit off there, a little bit on there, you know, do you think that's just right? And mm. it's this kind of labor of love, really, to just try and make things as good as we can.
You just mentioned there that you are going to be the next master of the Faculty of Royal Designers, and that we are here in Dartington at the end of a very intense summer school, which was looking at some very serious questions about society and the environment, and big issues. What's the benefit for you in doing something like this?
Well, I think it's being with younger people, I would say. Trish and I didn't have kids. We tried to have kids, but we weren't able to. And I do have probably somewhere in there a kind of nurturing gene that's needing to come out somewhere. And I've always liked being involved with younger designers and putting something back into the system. So that's an opportunity for me to do that. And it's kind of indulgent. I'm not here just to give. I'm here at the summer school to give and take. And hopefully those two things happen. But it's also, of course, to get out of my normal working environment, like all of us here, and get some really important moments from it, some epiphanies, as Chris Wise has asked us all to try and achieve. And this time, I think it's been as good as ever, in that sense.
And what kind of advice would you give to any young designer, particularly wanting to get into your field, which I think is probably more than most quite difficult, actually, the world of ceramics?
Well, it kind of is, but you know, you can soon point out to somebody that the ceramics industry as such has an incredible future. I mean, on the bathroom side of things, only a third of the world's population has running water in their home. So there's a fantastic opportunity to expand that industry.
Sure.
And, you know, think of the 1.3 billion Chinese people, most of which are picking up a piece of ceramics today. You know, it's massive, and it's not going to go away in a hurry. So I would be saying to young people, you have to think globally, and you have to understand what's going on around the world, but there's plenty of room for you in there. I sometimes kind of try and put people off.
Why?
Because I think you have to be quite strong and determined to succeed in design. If I think somebody is robust enough and they've come to talk to me about what they might do and what they're thinking, I sometimes make a judgment, are they robust enough not to collapse in tears at this point? And if I think they are and I feel it's right, I'll push back a bit and say, are you sure this is really the right thing for you, and challenge them on that. Mm. And that can be very positive. It can actually sometimes make people head off in another direction and suddenly everything falls into place.
Mm.
Because they're working their way through what they think they ought to be doing and isn't really for them. It's like my Hans Cooper moment when he made me understand I wasn't an artist.
Mm.
And I've had plenty of occasions when I know people have said to me later, my God, that was important, that we talked and you helped me see. There are a couple of people here who've asked to come and see me in my studio, and I've said, of course, yes to both. And they're both at a critical point, trying to figure out what their next step might be. And I think all of us with more experience, it's as simple as that, can offer some insights and some thoughts that might be helpful.
And what of you in the future? Do you have any areas yourself that you have never really sort of devoted your attention to but want to?
Not really. You know, this singular furrow, I think it's a love affair with ceramic. And When Paul Williams yesterday read out his piece about the lacquer bowl, you know, he and I had a little bit of a set to about it. I said, come on, you're telling me that a lacquer bowl is a nicer thing than a ceramic bowl. Of course, I went with it. But it is a kind of a love affair, and it's having made it and understood it in a deep way, it's pretty hard to shake off.
Mm.
And I've had such pleasure and fulfillment and enjoyment, I why should I do something else, you know? And I'm on the front end of the subject about which mankind has the longest continuous history. And so it doesn't bother me that 5, 6, 7, 8 thousand years ago people were making vessels, and that's what I'm doing. But there's still this crazy idea that we can make one better than the last one.
Well, on that on that note, and I mean, I hope that your love of continues. Robin Levine, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike.